We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome into another edition of the Josh Hendrickson Show. I'm Neil McCready here in the Clark Ford Studios, joined as always by Josh Hendrickson, the head of economics at economics department at Ole Miss. Did I get it wrong completely?
No, it's fine.
Okay. Yeah. You're about like me with titles. People are like, what do you want me to call you? I'm like, I don't know, whatever. and I'm like, you just say Rebel Grove, Rivals, something, MPW. It's been a while. How you been?
I can't complain. Getting ready for baseball season. My NCAA bracket's still intact, so things are all right.
Who'd you have in your Final Four?
I have UConn, North Carolina, Houston, and Tennessee.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've got Houston, UConn, Arizona, and Creighton. So, I don't know. I'd love for yours to be right. I would love to see Tennessee make a run. I like Rick Barnes. I like that team for the most part. We're taping this on Wednesday, March the 27th. The Cubs open tomorrow night. You're wearing your Cubs hat. You're in the mood. We're watching Kerry Wood and the 2003 Cubs play the Milwaukee Brewers right now on Marquee. What are your expectations for the Cubbies?
Pain. No, I have really low expectations.
I do too.
I think that last year I felt like their run came a little too early, and yes, I fell for it and I got excited, but they're essentially just running it back, and they didn't make the playoffs last year. So if you're just running it back, what are your odds? I mean, I get that the division kind of stinks, but it's...
Yeah, the division kind of stinks. The Brewers are going to take a step backwards, obviously. I think Cincinnati is going to be better. I think Pittsburgh is going to be a little better. And as much as it pains me to say it, I think it's odds are overwhelming that the Cardinals will be better. I don't know that they'll be significantly better, but they'll be better. They went out and got some pitching, although it's old. But, yeah, I thought they were a move short. I would have enjoyed seeing a little more activity, but I don't know. There was a valuation in Forbes, I think, today or the other day. Cubs were like $5.5 billion, and they don't want to go up past the first tax threshold. And obviously I'm not privy to the books. I don't know what they're in debt with the hotels or whatnot, but they're the fifth most valued franchise in baseball behind Dodgers, Yankees, Mets. No, they're fourth, right ahead of the Giants. And it seems like you should spend that way, but they don't. But now they've apparently left a lot of powder dry for if they make a run at the deadline. I saw where Jim Bowden predicted that the Cubs would trade for Pete Alonso at the deadline. That would be taking on salary. That would be, okay, we're good, let's do it. And I also get, I'm being long-winded about the Cubs here, I also get that they have a lot of good prospects on the way, and you don't want to just block everyone's potential progress. But at the same time, you should be more competitive than they've been.
Yeah. I'm also not a fan of the Bellinger contract, although it was sort of inevitable. But, you know.
You were in favor of a bigger deal? Or
no.
Or just not bringing him back?
I think the deal is just very much in his advantage, I guess. I mean, the best case scenario, honestly, for the Cubs is that he has a complete monster year and then he just opts out. I think that it's set up in favorable terms to him, and there's not much protection on the team side, you know, if last year was a fluke.
Oh no, he's going to get paid handsomely if it doesn't work out for on a three-year deal. I think the hope on him, and this is probably little pie in the sky, which is not my style, but is that he looked around this time and said, you know, guys didn't get what we thought they would get. This is a pretty good deal. I like it here. Maybe I'll just stay three seasons. Make good money, be in a position where maybe they give me another contract. Maybe you can redo the contract after 2 years where you've proven that you have some stability, where you make it more of a compromise. I don't know. I mean, but it has to spook him a little bit that 2 years in a row there really wasn't a lot of interest in him.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that it's, you know, He's just kind of a weird case. Like, you don't know if he just, you know, had this sort of temporary down period or if last year was just his, like, last hurrah, right?
Yeah.
So it's difficult, and it's difficult to determine what the market is for somebody like that.
He has looked good in the spring. I've watched some of their games in the spring. He has looked really good. Suzuki's looked terrific. Maybe that's the breakthrough. Maybe they get the entire season out of Seiya Suzuki that they got in the pretty much the whole second half when he was probably one of the better players in baseball. Maybe they get that for an entire season. I'm like you. I'm not going to get my hopes up. I'll just watch and follow along, and I'll let them build my hopes should they decide to.
You know, at the end of July, we're both going to be sitting here like, I don't know. I think they can make a run.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that I know enough about me to know that they'll sucker me in. They'll go win six in a row sometime. So one of these kids is going to come up and be electric, and I'm going to get into it. Then I'm going to start following the rumors, and then it will be Pete Alonso watch every day for like 3 weeks. I'll be cheering for the Mets to be a total disaster so that they trade him. And you know what? I hope so. Because it might be a good distraction this summer. You know, because it wasn't that long ago. You and I first started doing this. It was the election was still a year plus away. And you could talk about it, but you would talk about it in these futuristic terms. And the next time we do this, it's going to be April. I mean, we're taping this on March the 27th. Easter Sunday is the last day of March. Monday morning is April. That's the way it works. This is April. And you know what happens? April kind of gets going, got this great spring weather. Everybody goes outside when it's not pouring down rain. Baseball season starts. Little kids' baseball season gets rolling. Moms and dads have softball and baseball and spring soccer. Carson's refereeing spring soccer every Monday night out at M-Trade. And then the high school graduations roll around, and people are planning their summer trips. And the college baseball season gets into the postseason, and everybody's watching to see who gets to Omaha and who doesn't and all of that. And you look up, man, it's like middle of June. Everybody's going to the beach, Disney, wherever they go, hiking, whatever the case may be. And then I'll go to Media Days in Dallas this year. Never would have thought SEC Media Days would be in Dallas, but alas, here we are. And then you look up, and it's August 1st. And the kids are going back. The high school football teams are practicing. The high school bands are practicing. Kids are getting ready to go to school. I mean, it goes fast. We will look up. This thing's going to be September before you know it. And hopefully we're talking about a Cubs pennant race. But I know what we will be talking about. We're going to be talking more about Trump and Biden, I assume, because it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to deviate from their plan. They're going to go with Biden. The Republicans are going to go with Trump. And this thing, I mean, Lane Kiffin was, he said that the current transfer portal thing is shitty. And it made me, I used the term shit show earlier today about this. And I was like, I thought to myself, as soon as I hit the button at Rebel Grove, I was like, nah, man, the shit show is not the transfer portal. The shit show is going to be this election, because this election cycle, it looks like it's going to be psychopathic.
Oh, it's going to be insane. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you look at how things have already started off, and then you've got all of these, you know, you not only have like the sort of controversy that always surrounds Trump, but then you've got all of the legal stuff, and then you got Biden, and like things don't look good. Biden's not popular, but like he seems to think that he can just be popular as opposed to Trump. And yeah, it's I expect it to get pretty crazy. It's going to be, I think it's going to be a little bit nuts.
I don't know what to think of the polling data, but some of the polling data is like, wow, this thing could be razor's edge. It's a lot of Trump plus two or Biden plus one in swing states. Everything's inside the margin of error. There was one very realistic map that got put out. It was got them each to 269. And I was like, well, now that might be the step too far. That might be where we just go, okay, we're not going to make it through this. In case you don't know, you have to have 270 electoral college votes to win the White House. 269 does not get you there. If you finish with 269 electoral college votes, that is not enough on its own for you to become the president. And there is a way. It's not particularly convoluted. It was Biden winning Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. It was Trump winning, obviously, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Ohio, Arizona, Nevada, which is what it looks like today. I think Trump's probably in better shape in those swing states than Biden is in the ones that Trump's projected to win. But nonetheless, it's a completely realistic outcome based on the polling data today. And then it was, you just changed like one, you know, Kansas. One of the states, maybe it is Nebraska, has, you know, it's not all one thing. There's like got a little district that's one vote.
Mm-hmm.
And Maine kind of has a split thing too. And it was, you just split up the Maine thing and you split up the Nebraska thing in a way that probably is what's going to happen. 269 to 269. Is there a part of me that's really sick for sort of wanting that? Just to, A, watch the civics lesson that they no longer teach in schools. I'd kind of love to see that, just to see the total meltdown about the House. It would go to the House of Representatives. And then it's about how many states have more Republican delegates and how many states have more Democratic delegates. So if you're Alabama, for example, and you send, I'm just making up numbers, by the way, 18 Republican delegates and 5 Democratic delegates to Washington for the January 6th thing, then Alabama counts as a Republican state. If it's California and they send, you know, 70 Democratic delegates and 27 Republican delegates, it counts as one Democratic state for the Democrats. Well, there's 50, do the math, however it works out, boom. And then if it's tied there, is that when it goes to the Senate? And if it's potentially tied in the Senate, the vice president, no, the vice president is named by the Senate. The president is named by the House. So it's not inconceivable that you could have a Donald Trump, Kamala Harris administration. Where if I'm Trump, man, we're hiring a lot of extra Secret Service people at that point.
I kind of wonder, though, so like everything is really close, but I kind of wonder, because a lot can happen between now and then. And so one of the things that I kind of wonder is like, if there's some kind of like significant event or series of events between now and then, it can take something that looks very close and turn it very lopsided very quickly. Yeah. And so I kind of wonder if we're all just kind of expecting like this super tight race, and then maybe it turns out that it's not all that tight.
If I told you it was a landslide, who would you think won?
I think it would depend on, I think it would depend because, I mean, I can make a case for both. I mean, if, so, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit like off the air. There's a noticeable uptick in investment in manufacturing, and like, and by noticeable, I mean like, you know, historically large. And a lot of this has to do with some of the policies that Trump put in place. And some of it has to do with the CHIPS Act that Biden signed. The there's a lot of manufacturing investment that's going on. So what that means is like people are building factories and things like that. So it hasn't shown up in production, but it's showing up in investment. And so if that... If though I don't know at what stage a lot of those projects are at, but like if a lot of those projects are sort of nearing completion and you start to see this big boom in their production over the summer, I mean, I could easily see, you know, the data getting better and then people just kind of being like, well, you know, maybe things have turned around. Maybe we really did hit this soft landing, right? Maybe things won't be so bad. And then, you know, maybe Biden like wins really easily. But I can also see a scenario where nothing much changes, or maybe the economy deteriorates, you know, or maybe they just push too hard on all this Trump stuff legally.
Yeah,
that people just say no, like forget it, and then they and it, you know, and then that swings things towards Trump. Because I mean, I think one of the things that people don't realize is that when you can have like a very, very significant electoral college victory with a very small, you know, margin, right? I mean, if you just win a couple of, I mean, if you just win all the swing states, mm-hmm. right? Like, and maybe you only win them by 10,000, 15,000 votes or something. If you win all the swing states, the electoral college is going to look like you just destroyed this person, right?
And it could be basically 50-50 at the polls.
Yeah. And so it's, and so it'll be interesting because I do think that I do think that a lot of the commentary is way too pessimistic about Trump, because I think that they look at him and say, well, he's got a low ceiling. But the thing that I've been saying for a while is like Biden also has a low ceiling, because like he has a record to run on now, and the record's not impressive. And so that, and he's not particularly likable. Like he's never been particularly likable. That's one of the reasons like he never actually got the nomination. And when he ran before, it's, he was never a very likable guy. So he also has a pretty low ceiling. So yeah, I mean, I think things could tip very easily in one direction or the other.
How relieved are you on a scale of 1 to 10 that Chuck Todd's nightmare is over, that, that NBC has righted a wrong, Rachel Maddow and everyone, they don't have to worry about Rona McDaniel anymore. She can't kick them around the way she was gonna as an analyst.
I think that this illustrates something that I talk about on this show all the time. I talk about this all the time, and the thing that I talk about is, I think most people look at this and they say, look at how hypocritical they are. Right. Look at how hypocritical they are. You know, they have, you know, Jen Psaki, you know,
who doesn't exactly have a journalistic background, by the way.
I mean, no, Jen Psaki, like, I'm not sure this woman has ever had a real job. I'm serious, because I actually looked this up the other day. I was like, I wonder what her background is. And like, I'm not sure she's ever had a real job ever in her life. Like, I don't think like she ever. I mean, I don't know, maybe when she was a teenager or something, she was like a waitress, or she, you know, was a cashier or something. I don't know, like delivered pizzas. I mean, I don't know. But her entire working life, she's just been a press secretary mm-hmm. for political candidates. That's it. That's all she's ever done. And so so a lot of people look at that and they say, okay, well, here's a person that all they've ever done is been a press secretary for politicians in one particular party, and they don't have any problem with her being on the network, you know, but here is somebody who was in charge of the RNC, and now, like, they, you know, they're not allowed on the network. And isn't that hypocritical, because, you know, one person is just the mouthpiece for one party and one person is the mouthpiece for the other party. And so isn't this all just the same thing? And, like, isn't this very hypocritical? And what I always point out is, like, this is not hypocrisy. This is hierarchy. This is not, like, they're not hypocritical. Like, they have no principles. They have no principles. They don't want people they disagree with to have a voice, period.
Right.
It has nothing to do with, oh, this person used to be a spokesperson for the Republican Party, and we can't have former spokespeople on here. Like, I mean, first of all, she
supported an insurrection.
Right. And it's just the most preposterous thing ever if you take what they say at face value. But you have to realize that, like, what they're saying is they're appealing to they're trying to appeal to some sort of, like, American value of, like, equality and, like, unbiased journalism and things like that. The problem is that they're completely biased. And so, like, I don't know who those appeals actually work on, because this demonstrates exactly what they're for. And what they're for is that they are fine with anybody who's on their side, and they don't want to give a microphone, they don't want to give a platform to anybody who's on the other side. And they're perfectly willing to make arguments that sound principled, but that are but that have nothing to do with principle. It's all about helping their friends, harming their enemies, and pushing things along and demonstrating that, you know, they've already won. Like, they control the network, they control everything that goes on there, and this is their demonstration of power. Like, you think that you're in charge? You think that you can hire people? No, we're not going to allow you to hire those people. We're not going to talk to those people, and we're not going to give voice to those people that we disagree with. And they go out in public and make principled arguments, but they don't stand on principle. It's really just about, this person doesn't agree with me and I don't want them around. And they actually tip their hand on this, because I saw an interaction with, like, I forget. I think it was with Joy Reid and Rachel Maddow. I saw this little interaction, and Joy Reid said something like, oh, you know, I wouldn't mind having, you know, Republicans on my show. I would love to have, like, Liz Cheney on my show, or I would love
Romney.
It's like, and so it's just like, you're, like, tipping your hand here, right? You're just saying, like, yes, I enjoy having, like, the people that, like, you know, that, like, nobody in their actual party likes them, right? Like, I like having them on because, you know, they're saying things that I agree with, and it's the most ridiculous thing. But it's an important point, and it's an important point for people to recognize, is that it looks hypocritical, but it's not, because to call them hypocritical is to assume that they have principles, but they don't have principles. Like, it's just help our friends, harm our enemies.
You know, the thing that I'm curious about, and I don't know the answer, and I don't think you do either. I don't know how either one of us could possibly even really know. I guess we could have a theory. I do wonder whether your, quote, average American even pays any attention to them anymore. And the reason I say that is there was a story that came out recently. It was Joe Rogan's Spotify numbers. They're monstrous. And then you look around at some of the other podcasts that got mentioned, and they're doing well. And I just kind of wonder, you and I are both a little older. We grew up in houses, at least I did. I think you kind of did too, where mom and dad kind of got the news from the TV news, got a newspaper in the morning. You know, I got up every morning and there was the Shreveport Times and the Monroe News Star. And in the afternoon, we got the Ruston Daily Leader. Newspapers were a part of my life. Well, my kids and your kids, they don't read newspapers, and they never will. My dad came home from work. He taught at Louisiana Tech most of when I was a kid. Sometimes he had night classes, but usually he was home from work around 5:15, 5:20. And he'd watch the CBS Evening News usually, 5:30. And at 6, the Monroe local news would come on. And they'd watch the first 10, 15 minutes of that. And then that was their news. If they were still up at 10 o'clock, you might turn on the 10 o'clock news just to see what's going on. But for the most part, that was it. That's where you got your news. And you generally trusted, for lack of a better word, Dan Rather or Walter Cronkite or Peter Jennings with ABC after, you know, whatever. They weren't talking heads long enough for you to really form much of an opinion about them, right? And now the news is just these talking heads all day. And I don't know that anybody really under about the age of 35, 40 pays any attention to them whatsoever. I mean, Chuck Todd and them could be having a complete meltdown. And I just kind of wonder what percentage of the American populace is even aware.
Well, it reminds me, I don't know if you've ever heard this Norm MacDonald bit, but Norm MacDonald has this bit where he was like, yeah, you know, when I was a kid, you know, we had the local news for a half hour, and then we had, you know, like the national news for a half hour, and like that's all you got. It was like an hour of news, like, yeah, for the whole day. That's it. And he's like, you know, and like today you turn on the television and there's not just like 24-hour news, like there's multiple different stations that have 24 hours of news, and they've got all different, and they're all talking about different things, and they're just, you know, and he's like, and you know, I think about that, and I think about when I was a kid, and I think that yeah, we kind of had it right. So
yeah, we did.
And that's that's kind of what it reminds me of, because first of all, there is like an oversaturation of news. But also I think that there is a significant segment of the population that is watching, you know, these shows, and that is watching the evening news, but that these people, that audience is getting smaller over time because those people are getting older and then those people are passing away.
Yeah.
I don't think that this will, I don't think that these things will survive, but I don't think that they'll survive for a couple of reasons. Number one, like, just the viewing habits across generations are very, very different. And so it's not going to be sustainable. But the other thing is that they've also just like thrown all of their credibility out the window, is that they've demonstrated that they're not straight shooters. They've demonstrated that, like, you know, the biggest problem that they had is, I think that they had this like quasi monopoly on the news. And so they were protected from certain things. And it's like technology has progressed at a speed to which they can't catch up. And I don't mean catch up in terms of like figuring out new, better ways to do the same thing that they're doing with a new audience. What I mean is, like, I remember when the internet was new, you had like the most hilarious things happening with politicians, because, you know, like the old thing that politicians used to be able to do is, like, you know, you would go talk to the Chamber of Commerce and you'd be like, oh, like, we're not going to pass these bills like this, you know, like that's going to destroy businesses. And, you know, I'm not going to do that sort of thing. And then you'd go talk to some like environmental group and you'd be like, look, we got to pass this bill. I don't care if it's going to bankrupt these people. Right? Like, we got to do this. And
getting votes, baby. Yes,
and you could just go around and you could do that. And, you know, and to a certain extent, like, you know, there were limitations on that because, you know, when you get in office, they actually observe what you do and things like that. So there were limitations on the sort of cheap talk that you could engage in. But I remember, like, when the internet was first a thing, it was like all the time, like the big story on like the nightly news would be like, somebody's got a recording of this politician saying, like, you know, X is good, but here they are at this thing saying X is bad. Right. And yeah, you're just like, and they're like, you know, and the thing about it was that was remarkable to me. It was like that it took a lot of politicians a long time to actually like adjust to that. Like the ones that were really good at telling people what they wanted to hear, it was really hard for them to adapt to the fact that, like, hey, now that the internet is a thing, and now that like people can like record me themselves with, like, you know, their own camcorder or later on their phones, right? Like, yeah, I can't just say things in a room because it's not private. Like, everything that I say is now a public statement.
Yeah.
And it took them forever. And I think that this is kind of, you know, like, we're seeing kind of some of the same things with like these media outlets, because you can watch like 60 minutes and they'll have, you know, some 15-minute segment with people, and you watch it and you have an impression from that 15-minute segment about, like, you know, what's going on and what, you know, and like, who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, like, what's, you know, like, what the controversy is, whatever. But then the thing that happens is, like, these people who are interviewed, like, they bring people to do, like, their own recording, and then they say things like, oh, yeah, so you saw that 15-minute segment. Well, we actually talked to them for 2 hours. Here's the whole 2-hour interview.
Yeah.
And then you watch the 2-hour interview, and you're like, you know, watching the 2-hour interview, I get a much different impression of what's going on here than what I got, like, the 15-minute segment. And they still have not adapted to that. The other thing is,
that's why they're so mad at Elon Musk right now. They like 60 Minutes, they had a segment the other day about social media, and just it was interesting to watch a you know, award-winning, renowned program. It's part of a major US network that goes way back, CBS, bitching about the First Amendment. I mean, really saying, you know, I mean, I realize it's the First Amendment, but do we really need that much of the First Amendment? I mean, is it really good that people can express their opinions? Isn't that hate speech? And, you know, it shows you that for many in my field, that is the agenda. The agenda is not to be right or to inform even. It's to bully.
Well, but I think part of this NBC thing is, like, it's a show of strength in the sense that they're able to get people fired.
Uh-huh.
But their collective strategy is actually, like, a sign of weakness, because they feel like they, like, these people legitimately seem to think that, like, they are holding, like, that, like, there is a dam.
Mm-hmm.
And that dam is holding back all of these things they don't want you to hear, or that they don't want you to know. And if it wasn't for them, this dam would collapse. And they got to just stand there and they got to hold it up. And how dare you bring somebody else along who might not be, you know, on the same page with us in terms of, like, holding up this dam. And the issue is like, what they don't realize is, number one, the dam already broke.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, we've seen, like, like, what happened when the dam broke, and actually it turned out it's fine. Like, because, like, we are adults and we can listen to information and we can make our own assessment about whether or not we think that it's true. We can make our own assessment about whether or not we believe these people. We can make our own assessments about whether we think somebody is honest or lying. We can make our own assessments about whether somebody is doing things for legitimate reasons or whether they're just, like, grifting, right? Like, we can do, like, we can make those judgment calls. And that doesn't mean that we always get it right.
Right.
And it doesn't mean on average that we get it right. It doesn't even mean that, like, the majority of the population gets it right. The point is that people can evaluate their own information. And you see this because when you think about those podcasts, you know, they tell you nobody's going to listen to a 3-hour podcast, right? And, like, Joe Rogan will just sit down with somebody for 3 hours and it has, like, millions of downloads.
Yeah.
Right. Now, look, is everybody listening all the way through the third hour? I have no idea. But the thing is that, you know, they're listening to a lot of it. Right. And you know that they're listening to a lot of it because not only are they listening to it, but, like, people post clips of it. People are sharing it. People are talking about it. And so
we're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
The media is sort of stuck, like the sort of mainstream kind of, you know, legacy media is just kind of stuck in this position where they're trying to hold on to what they once had. They're trying to, like, you know, build this dam to prevent people from all of this, you know, horrible misinformation or whatever. And, you know, but time has passed them by. The dam is already broke. We're already all, you know, floating on down the river.
An example of that is something I think you wanted to talk about, which was the Biden administration. And I get why they do it. They tell you, hey, the economy's better than you people think it is. Inflation's not as bad as you guys think it is. Why can't you see how good the economy is? Well, that's their job, right? They're running an election. But the media parrots it too. You know, they'll sit up there, Good Morning America. Why is middle America, if you will, so insistent that the economy is bad when we're telling you that it's really good? And it's, well, now, unlike in a previous era, people can get on social media and give anecdotes about what things cost, what they paid at the market for milk or for bread or for whatever the case may be. They can show people, hey, this is my, I went and intentionally bought, I saved, some woman had saved her receipts. So she went back to the store and bought the exact same things months later, and it's more expensive. Same brands, same volume, same everything. It's more expensive. And so the people can discuss that amongst themselves in a way that maybe they couldn't a generation ago. Hell, maybe even just a few years ago when, you know, it's now documented during the pandemic, all the social media outlets were monitored, were, what's the word I'm looking for? They were censored. You don't really have that completely now. And so the job that I think they're trying to do in media, it's no longer real. Like you said, the dam's already broken. They can't really do it. No one's really listening. The percentage of people who are listening to them is just lower now.
Well, and frankly, it's probably a lot of self-selection too. I mean, it's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of people who want somebody to sort of curate the news for them, right? And mm-hmm. so like they're just sort of self-selecting into that. Whereas people who are curious or people who want to dig in on a particular topic, like maybe you don't care about everything that's on the news, but maybe you care about one particular topic or something, like you can now seek that out and you can go as in depth as you want. Like there are like anonymous guys on Twitter who will post these incredible threads about, like, you know, supply chain issues or something, and you're just like, you know, just, you know, it's like,
yeah,
Steve 0357653, right? And he's, you know, and it's just like some anonymous guy, and like we'll post like the most amazing thing, and you can find these things. And but in terms of like the one thing I want to talk about in terms of like the economy and how they talk about this stuff is, for the longest time now, I mean, I think like we've referenced this probably, you know, on multiple podcasts by now, it's like there's this attitude that like everything is great, and why won't people just recognize that everything is great? Like, aren't you looking around? Don't you see how great things are? And, you know, and the thing I always say is, well, if things are really great, you don't have to tell people that they're great. But it is kind of a mystery, because some of the economic data that we have makes it hard to understand particular attitudes, right? So, for example, if you know, like historically speaking, if you just know like what the inflation rate is and you know what like the unemployment rate is, like you can pretty accurately predict like when they release these things about like consumer sentiment and how confident people are in the economy, like you can predict that like really easily if you just know like the inflation rate and the unemployment rate. You just need two data points and you can pretty accurately guess how people think about the economy. And the funny thing about this is that there are some economists who have been pointing out that, like, well, if you look at the inflation rate and you look at the unemployment rate, consumer confidence should be way higher. But there's a lot of these economists who have kind of viewed this as, well, this is just a sign that people don't get it. That people don't realize like how good things are. And like maybe they're just not consuming the right news, or like maybe we're not doing a good enough job of like getting out, like, you know, like how great things are, or like what, you know, whatever. And there's this attitude that like, you know, people just don't get it. They're not observing the data. But last week there was a paper that got put out, and the paper was put out by four economists. Nobody would know any of them except one, which is Larry Summers. Larry Summers, very famous, very high ranking, like, economics advisor to Bill Clinton, to Barack Obama. Like, so number one, he's a Democrat. Number two, like, you know, he's very well known person, has an established reputation, right? So, him and three other economists put out this paper, and they put out this paper where they said, hey, like, maybe what's going on is that we're calculating inflation wrong. And in some sense, like, we know that, like, that inflation is calculated wrong just because, like, there's limitations on data collection, right? So, like, we can't get every single price of things that people buy, and every single quantity of things that people buy, and figure out how to construct a weighted average of like every single price that exists in the economy. So, I mean, we know that there are limitations to what we're measuring. There's some degree of measurement error here. But one of the, like, a criticism of how we measure inflation that's been around for a long time is that we tend to measure inflation by looking at prices right now and then tracking those same prices over time. And when I describe it like that, it doesn't seem like there's any sort of problem. But the one problem about that is like, if you're talking about prices at a particular point in time, there are certain like prices that you're paying for that are not included in like that index. So for example, like the interest payments that you're paying on your mortgage, like the interest payments that you're paying on like a car loan, right? The interest payments that you might have on a credit card. Those things are also expenses that you're making, and we need to take those into account. And so for a long time, people have recognized that, like, hey, actually, like, those kinds of expenditures should actually be included in like how we calculate inflation, not just, you know, like, what's the price of bread today? Okay, now what's the price of bread, you know, a month from now, et cetera, right? And because when you're buying a car, anybody who's ever bought a car realizes this. Like, when you're buying a car or when you're buying a house, you're not just concerned with like how much the car costs on the sticker or how much the house costs. You're concerned because most people, and this is borne out by the data, like, most people are buying a car or a house with a loan. And so one component of what you're paying is that interest cost. And yeah, you're spreading out that interest cost over the course of the loan, but that's part of the cost. And so if I'm looking at like the price of a house, the price of a house shouldn't be like the price that's advertised what you're paying, right? Like, the price should include the amount of interest that you're having to pay. And so what these guys did is they went back and they reconstructed like the inflation rate using all the data that we already have, but then adding in like these interest costs. And when they added in the interest costs, what they discovered is that the inflation rate that we observe and that we have observed since, you know, the post-pandemic, when everything kind of reopened, what they show is that the inflation rate has been systematically higher. The inflation rate has been systematically higher over that period of time. And not only that, but like, if you go back and you look at the data, what it looks like when you look at the data is that, what it looks like is that inflation peaked, you know, somewhere around, 10%, 9%, 10%. And what they show is like, with their alternative measure, it actually peaked, at around like 18%. Okay, so that's a huge difference. Okay,
yeah.
But their point is that the inflation rate has been systematically higher when measured their way, and what that means is that by like ignoring these costs associated with car loans and credit card debt and house payments and things like that, you're actually you're systematically biasing the inflation rate downwards. And the thing that's important here is that, you know, so what they do is they said, okay, look, if you take the inflation rate and you take the unemployment rate and you predict consumer sentiment, we're getting very bad predictions in comparison to like what we actually observe. But what they show is that like if you replace the official inflation rate with their alternative, it actually explains the overwhelming majority of that gap in consumer confidence. So in other words, their measure of inflation is actually doing a much better job at capturing like what consumers see as the cost of living than the official statistics are. And so in other words, the official statistics are just kind of biasing inflation downwards. And so, yeah, when you look at that estimate that's kind of biased downwards, yeah, it doesn't make sense why people are upset. But if you take into account the fact that there are all these other costs that don't go into that official calculation, when you take those things into effect, now all of a sudden, now it completely makes total sense why people are so pessimistic, because they see their cost of living rising substantially more than the official statistics say that they are. And so, of course, they're not happy, right? But this is kind of a big thing, because to me, this is a really significant paper. And it's a really significant result, and it does a really good job at kind of testing like external validity, because they don't even say like, hey, we're not saying that like our measure of inflation is a better way, like, you know, from a pure theoretical perspective. But what they're saying is like their measure is a much better representation of like how people see the cost of living. But there is theoretical literature that backs up, you know, and justifies exactly what they're doing. And so I think that's really important, but it hasn't gotten a lot of attention. It's been, I think, like some financial news networks and things like that picked up on it, but I'm pretty sure they picked up on it because Larry Summers' name is on it, and so, you know, they can generally get Larry on television, and so they've kind of mentioned it, but it hasn't gotten much play. But to me, this is a huge This is a huge like result, because it provides the explanation for why we can't understand why, people don't just admit that things are so great, because it turns out that like things aren't as great as they say that they are, right? Like they're not, the inflation rate has been higher than what's been reported, and that people are seeing that, and they're seeing that when they go to try to buy a car, they're seeing that when they go to the grocery store, they're seeing that when they go try to buy a house. And they're seeing that as like their credit card payments are going up because interest rates are going up. Like these are things that people see. These are things that people experience. And those things are reflected in consumer sentiment. And the fact that the official statistics don't pick up on those things is an indictment of the official statistics, not of like, you know, the average person's judgment.
100%. I mean, again, people know that things are more expensive now, and that if everything's more expensive, then increasing at a rate faster than the rate at which wages are increasing, it doesn't matter what the numbers tell them. They have their own internal numbers. I was searching for a tweet that someone sent to you and I earlier today, you and me, I should say, my mother would correct my English. And it's about a topic that comes up a lot. And I think the numbers are so big. It's my opinion. The numbers are so big that people can't relate. And I'm having trouble getting on Twitter. I don't know if you have yours pulled up or not. Twitter is not happy with me right now. I can't remember. There it goes. I can't remember my password. So it is, it's angry with me, but it's okay. They're trying to protect me. I'm appreciative of their attempt to protect. Where is it? It's a little bit further ahead. Here we go. All right, this is a professor. I don't know who he's a professor for. I'll find out real quick. He does daily videos on economics and freedom. He's an economist, former professor. His name is Peter St. Ange, Stonge. St. Ange. He says, in case you were thinking of retiring someday, bad news from Janet Yellen. Social Security and Medicare are now underfunded by $175 trillion. Again, I rest my case about numbers. People hear that number and they're like, I don't know what that means. Self-included. That comes to roughly $1.4 million per American household. So St. Ange says there are only three solutions. One, you can slash beneficiaries. Two, you can massively hike taxes. Or you can cut everybody's benefit to poverty level. Frankly, none of those sound all that appealing. I'm a big believer in elections have consequences. And I can tell you that one of the consequences of a Biden reelection, at least in my opinion, is that they're going to raise taxes.
Well, there is another option, and I think this is actually the more likely option, and that is we just continue to kick the can down the road and we just try to borrow the money to pay for it. I think that's the more likely option because, like, let's face it, nobody's going to cut spending. It's political suicide.
And both of these people, Biden and Trump, were both massive spenders in the White House.
And they're not going to cut, well, and especially they're not going to cut like Social Security and Medicare, right? Like those are things they're not going to cut. So they're not going to cut that. They're not going to reduce beneficiaries. I think like maybe the one other solution that you might see somebody try and it might actually succeed at some point is raising the retirement age where you start collecting Social Security. So people have much longer lifespans now. So you could make that argument. I think it's going to be hard to make that argument, but you could potentially phase that in, right? So you could basically just say like, hey, if you're like 20 years old now, like your retirement age is going to be like 70 or 75 or something like that. Well, now they've got 55 years to prepare for that. You're not going to be able to do that by like telling current like 60-year-olds like, oh, hey, you thought you were going to collect Social Security at 65. Well, it turns out 75 is the number now. Yeah. So, like, good luck to you.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to do that. It's political suicide. Medicare is much, much harder because Medicare, like, trying to cut Medicare is very difficult because Medicare is not, like, Social Security is just giving checks to people, right? Medicare is paying for services. It's much harder to try to figure out ways to cut that because how are you going to cut it? The only way that you can cut it is by telling doctors like, hey, we're going to pay you less for this service than we did before. But what happens in that scenario is doctors see fewer Medicare patients and they see more private insurance patients. I actually worked on some research related to this and Medicare, now admits this is that they for every dollar that they cut, they actually only save something like 70 cents. Because what happens is like when they try to cut reimbursement, what doctors tend to do is they tend to, over the long run, they tend to just order more services, right? So, maybe they do an extra test here or there, right? And that, that they might not have normally done. And it's not even necessarily that they're doing it, deliberately. It's not like they're like maliciously being like, oh, I'll show you. You're not going to cut. Right. But like, it's just natural financial incentives are going to lead some people to kind of be like, Medicare will pay for the test. I'll just order them the test. And so I think that we have a massive problem, but the massive problem is not confined to Social Security and Medicare. I think Social Security and Medicare are just the things that are going to be, along with like defense, are going to be the things that are hardest to cut politically. The problem is like once you set aside Social Security, Medicare, and defense, and you're basically said like those things are untouchable. Well, you've now set aside like a huge portion of the budget that you're saying is untouchable. And so now what are you going to touch? What are you going to do? And we're already borrowing ridiculous amounts of money. I mean, I think I sent you the
Congressional Budget Office forecast.
Yeah.
Which is just, for those of you who don't have ESPN 12, it's just a steep mountain up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just like they're basically projecting that by 2050, like we have almost that the debt to GDP ratio is almost like 200%. And so
I mean, I know you've answered this before. I'm going to ask it for the guy and the girl who's listening going, okay, but how long is that sustainable? Like you, if I have my American Express and I max it out and I borrow another credit card, I get another credit card to, quote, pay off my American Express. And then I build up the credit on that. And I keep doing this. At some point, when I apply for a new credit card, they go, nah. No. And I know it's a lot more complicated than that. But at what point are we creating a situation where we're jeopardizing the future of our grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, whatever the case may be?
Well, it's already on an unsustainable path. I mean, it's already unsustainable. But the question is, like, what? How long, you know, how long can you avoid the costs? They don't even have to, like, necessarily eliminate the deficit. If they could just get the deficit low enough that the economy is growing faster than the debt, right, then, like, you can actually get a longer-term solution here, because if you can continue to kind of push things off, if the economy is growing faster than the debt, you know, while your tax base is growing faster than the debt, and so, you know, you can get back on the sustainable path. But they're not even committed to that. Like, they were like, forget like running balanced budgets. Like, they're not even committed to getting the deficit to grow at a slow enough rate.
We've opened the border. We're sending an obscene amount of money to Ukraine. We're financially involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict. We have myriad problems at home that are underfunded. We have an infrastructure problem in our country that both parties are responsible for. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So when you try to even think of how do you even come up with a balanced budget with all of that spending, the only way is to raise taxes. They're already too high.
Well, and this is the issue, is that it's not just about raising taxes. Like, to raise tax, like, you can tell that politicians aren't serious, because the politicians who even mention taxes, like, they still say, well, we're just going to tax like the billionaires. Like, and it's like, well, that's not going to generate enough revenue. And so, you know, to actually have higher taxes that would make a difference, like, this would have to be higher taxes across the board. Every single taxpayer is going to have to pay a higher tax rate. Ultimately, there's one of two outcomes here. Like, based on this unsustainable path, I think that there's one of two likely outcomes. One outcome is that at some point in the near future, we get some kind of productivity boom, and that productivity boom causes the economy to grow faster. Mm-hmm. And we get this period of higher growth, and that period of higher growth, offsets these deficits that we're running, and it starts to put us in a better financial position. Now, if you're banking on a massive increase in productivity, let me tell you that the United States economy has effectively grown at the same rate since like 1789. So if you're banking on like some massive increase in economic growth in the near term, like, I think that you maybe need to temper those expectations. But I think the thing here is that the likely outcome is that a lot of this stuff is going to get inflated away. Because here's the difference between the situation you described about like the individual versus the government. I mean, it's the same basic principle. At a certain point, somebody cuts you off. At a certain point, somebody says no more. The difference is that the United States government has a central bank. And that central bank, when somebody says no more and the treasury market goes haywire, the central bank is going to step in and they're going to say, hey, we got to settle things down, and we're going to intervene in this market. We're going to buy some treasuries. We're going to figure out, like, you know, what we can do to kind of reduce the volatility in this market. But in the process, what that's going to mean is that the debt that other people aren't willing to buy, the central bank is going to buy that debt. And if the central bank is going to buy that debt, you're just monetizing the debt. And when you monetize the debt, you just get higher rates of inflation. And so if you're going to get higher rates of inflation, that's the way that you're paying off the debt. I mean, the thing that they can do that you can't do is you can't just go, you know, into another room in your house and like print more dollars and give them to somebody. They do have that tool.
You could, but
well, yes. I mean, it's not going to work.
It wouldn't be recommended.
The Secret Service, you will get to meet the Secret Service, though.
Yeah, you would. I'm just correcting you. You technically could.
Yeah. But I think those are the two most likely scenarios. Now, even in the inflation scenario, there's a couple possibilities here. So one possibility is that this happens all at once. And in that case, that's very, very bad because you just get this period of just like super high rates of inflation just wipes out people's purchasing power and wipes out the real value of your wealth and all of these kinds of things. That sort of event is catastrophic, but but solving this through inflation could be like a sort of very slow process. Like it could be like instead of having like 2% of inflation a year, like we're used to, or at least we were used to pre-pandemic, maybe you have like 5% inflation a year, or maybe you have 6% inflation a year. And that sucks and that's terrible and we don't want that. But it's better than 1 year of 100% inflation or something like that.
Yeah.
I think that's we're on this path where the federal government in the United States, they have too many obligations. They have Social Security, they have Medicare. Social Security is effectively a Ponzi scheme, and I'm not saying that in a derogatory way. It's like literally a Ponzi scheme. Like the way a Ponzi scheme works is like I take money from you and I promise to give you money in the future, and then where do I get that money? I go to somebody else and I get that money, and then I take their money and I give it to you. For the government, that's how this works, right? They collect taxes, and those taxes that they're collecting from workers today are not like put in a box somewhere with your name on it, right? Like those dollars just are going to pay out current retirees. And so when we retire in the future, the hope is that the generation that's working will be paying into it to pay our retirement, right? But there's nothing waiting for us. And the point is if the population is always the same size, if income is always growing, like that sort of thing can be sustainable when it's operated through a government because the government has the power to tax. Mm-hmm. But if you have like a baby boom generation where there's a lot of people retired relative to the people who are working, or if you have a period of relative stagnation in the economy where incomes aren't growing a lot, right, then tax revenues aren't going to keep up. And so what's going to happen is you reach a point where you actually just have to start borrowing to pay for Social Security, which is supposed to be self-financing through the payroll tax. But at a certain point, they're going to have to borrow money. And but then, you know, you think about all of these other programs, you think about Medicare, you think about defense, you think about all of these other budgets that they have, that they're, all these other budget commitments that they have, where are you going to cut? Like, what's the thing that is going to solve the problem? I mean, we could like eliminate like the Department of Education tomorrow and it wouldn't solve our problem, right? Like that's where we are, right? I mean, like the fourth largest expense, like on the Treasury's, outlays is interest on the debt. So that's, this is not encouraging.
But we could eliminate, we could bite into it. We could eliminate some of the fat. You could be far more judicious in the amount of money that you send elsewhere. You could incentivize employment growth. I mean, there are things that you could do that would slowly, but maybe not even slowly, but surely, maybe just slowly help reduce the bloat, right?
Well, the Social Security problem is a demographic problem, is that people live a lot longer than 65 years old. And so they're collecting Social Security for a lot longer than like the original plans were for like the program. Also, we're at a point where the retiring population is like a very, very large generation relative to subsequent generations. So there are structural issues with that that could only be solved really through, you know, like raising the retirement age for people in the future. But the other thing is like, I guess what I'm saying is there are lots of things that we could do, but the question is sort of like, what's politically feasible? And there aren't a lot of people who are willing to do the right thing at the expense of their own career. And so if you are a career politician, you might not want to enact that tax increase. You might not want to eliminate, you know, departments within the government or something like that to save money, because there's a constituency that gets benefits from you know, those programs or those departments, and they're not going to want to give that up. And so you're likely to suffer electoral defeat when you do those things. And so, you know, how many politicians are willing to stand up and say, I don't care if I, you know, if I'm not reelected, like this is the right thing to do. You know, it's possible, but that's not something that like I tend to count on in terms of predicting people's behavior.
No, for sure. Anything else, Josh? We're trying to solve the world's problems. You're doing a better job of it than I do. I just get frustrated. I'm like this. I keep waiting for the common sense people to kick in, and they just don't. Probably because common sense can't get elected.
Well, I think that I think that you are so. I mean, there is cause for optimism. I think what we've been suffering through for over a decade now is like a competency crisis. Like it seems like every like major event that we face, like it just seems like the people who are in charge and who aren't like they're not prepared for the crisis. Like they don't know how to deal with it. They're not, you know, they don't have the knowledge or the training or the skills or just, you know, the ability to make decisions under pressure that are successful. Right. So like, you know, you can probably think about like the, you know, there's sort of evidence of this going back, over 20 years. I mean, you think about like, you know, this kind of started with like the Iraq War. Like it wasn't executed well. They constantly had to change strategies. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even clear what the objectives were, right? Same thing with Afghanistan. You had the financial crisis and like people see, you know, the people in power seemed incredibly ill-equipped to do that. I mean, I don't know if you've ever heard the story, but like they asked that one time they asked somebody like how they came up with the number for TARP. Remember TARP? That was the program where they were going to buy all these troubled assets, and the government tried to pass this bill. This was during the financial crisis, and everybody was freaking out about this. It's kind of funny to think about it now when I tell you like what it cost is like, they said like, oh, this is going to cost like $700 billion, which is like one check to Ukraine now. But back then this was like, you know, a huge amount of money. And, but when like subsequently, like when people, when reporters went back and like wrote books about this and talked to the policymakers at the time, they're like, how did you come up with this $7 billion or $700 billion? And they were like, oh, $700 billion. Well, we just made it up. It just sounded like the right number.
Well, it's kind of like the six feet. Stay six feet apart.
Yeah.
Is there science there? No, it just sounds good.
Yeah. They just were like, oh, it was like a ballpark figure. It sounded like enough. And it's just like, So we've sort of had this competency crisis for a long time. And this competency crisis, I think that people are actually starting to recognize it. And I think that if I'm correct in that, then we should start to actually see corrections, because we should actually start to see people demanding that people are more accountable, and like that additional accountability is going to coincide with, you know, are you competent in this job? Can we trust you to do this well? You know, how do you handle things in a crisis? Like, how do you, how do you make decisions? Do we get good outcomes when you're in charge? Right. Like these kinds of things, right now. And, you know, in the recent past, we seem to have just been selecting based on like where you went to school, or like, you know, if you knew somebody who could get you the job. And
well, I mean, along these lines, we have this crisis in Baltimore. The port of Baltimore is closed. It's a top 10 U.S. port. A lot of commerce comes in and out of Baltimore. We have Pete Buttigieg on the job.
He probably pretended to ride his bike, though, to the press conference.
We have Pete Buttigieg on the job. In what world is he qualified to be the transportation secretary in the middle of a crisis? And no. This is a crisis. This is an economic crisis. In what you say this all the time. I've got where I quote you on it. We're not a serious country. We're not a serious country. And what bothers me about it is I just wonder at some point, we open the show talking about the Cubs. If you're not a serious baseball team, I'm not saying the Cubs aren't, but you understand what I'm saying. If you just make decisions kind of whatever, no conviction, no plan, no analytics, just willy-nilly, you won't win. And eventually, not only will you not win, you'll lose badly. Like, you might have a couple of moments where, hell, it looks kind of good. Swept the Astros. Look at that. Then you turn around and lose 12 in a row. 15 out of 19. Because you have no plan. You have no farm system. You trade your farm system away for some 37-year-old guys to make a run at the wild card. It kind of feels like that's what we do a little bit. I mean...
Oh, we're definitely there now.
Well, look where we are right now. We talked about the presidential election. We are running two people who should not be running for president. They shouldn't be. And that's where we are. And whoever wins, if Biden wins, it's essentially electing Kamala Harris, who is completely unqualified. And if Trump wins, he walks in and you know what he goes up against starting day one, a system that will fight him from day one. Again, you're not a serious country. At some point, you face serious, you lose.
The one ray of hope that I have is that, and who knows? Maybe this is not, maybe I'm wrong about this, or maybe other people haven't noticed what I've noticed, or who knows? But to me, like, the biggest benefit of sort of like the Trump presidency was it really forced people to reveal who they really were.
Yeah.
Like the people who are just political hacks, like, it became obvious that they're just political hacks. People who will just do anything, for the good of their party. But it also revealed like that there are agencies within the government that actually are pretty autonomous. Like, you know, like, it actually doesn't seem to matter who you elect. They kind of just do whatever they want to do independent of that. And there are a lot of sort of instances like that. And so I think like one of the benefits is kind of like this of that presidency is that it kind of pulled back the curtain on Washington and revealed, you know, I guess if I'm going to say pulled back the curtain, it revealed who the wizard really is, right? It's very disappointing. And so I think that people have a tendency to focus on all the controversy and all the negative. But I mean, the one thing that gives me hope is that there were a lot of problems in Washington. There are a lot of problems within our bureaucracy that were largely going unnoticed and unknown. Because there wasn't anybody to shine a light on them. There wasn't anybody who would be mired in a controversy that would reveal these things. And I think that I see a lot of this as a competency problem. And the thing is that voters, whatever you want to say about voters, voters seem to be very practical people. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be very pragmatic people. And they tend to look around and just kind of go, you know, we send you here to do a job. And if you don't do the job or you don't do it well, like, you need to go. And I think that, like, we're reaching that point where people are realizing, like, we're at this sort of culmination point where people have seen elements of the government that don't live up to expectations. But I think everybody has a tendency to kind of see these things as, like, isolated incidents. And I think now what people are starting to realize is, like, no, this is, like, a systematic problem. And it's a systematic problem where these bureaucracies run themselves. The people who are in charge are not selected for competence. They're selected on other criteria, or they're selected for reasons that are correlated with competence, but in their particular case, not very strongly. And right. And so I think that, like, these there's becoming a clear and consistent pattern of incompetence and a clear and consistent pattern of people who just aren't up to the task. And that gives me some hope because voters tend to be very practical and pragmatic. And so if I'm seeing this, I imagine that many voters are seeing this and they'll say that, you know, sort of like enough is enough. And that will start the process of changing things. But the process is going to, but this is another thing that I say all the time is like, we also have to stop having this attitude of like, who's coming to save us. Right. Mm-hmm. Because we tend to like live and die on these elections, and we tend to think that like, OK, well, if we just elect Donald Trump or we just elect Joe Biden, like then they'll put the right people in charge. And the thing is like that's never going to solve the problem. Like these are systematic issues and it's going to take time. And so what you need is you need at least somebody who can start that process and somebody who can get things moving in the right direction and create that momentum and potentially do things that sort of shock the system to get this stuff started, to let people know that things are different and that there's going to be accountability. And I think that if we're able to get that, you know, we can turn a lot of things around. If we don't get that, we're on a very unsustainable path in many ways.
As always, thanks for the time.
No problem.
That's Josh Hendrickson for the Josh Hendrickson Show. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. We'll do it again. It'll be April by then. No more March. The brackets will be done. Hell, the Masters will be over, I think. We'll be in the middle of baseball season. We're proud to report that the Cubs are going to win this game 9-2, I think, from 21 years ago. So maybe the next time you're in, we'll watch a game that's actually happening now. For Josh, I'm Neil. Until then, take care.